The market's uncertain, revenue's tight, and hiring on hold. That's why results-driven companies are using Upwork to keep work moving. Go to Upwork.com today and start hiring proven freelance talent fast. No bulky overhead. No rigid long-term contracts. Just the right expert right when you need them. Work smarter and faster with Upwork. Go to Upwork.com now and find your freelance expert. That's UPWORK.com. Post a job for free and get started today.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
There's a superseding indictment that was brought down by the new D.C. grand jury in the January 6th case this week. What does that mean? Tell us.
The most biggest change in the indictment was to get rid of conversations that Trump had with other members of the government. And other than that, the indictment charges exactly the same crimes. The case is now stronger because it's more focused.
There's more than enough here to send him to prison for several years.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to George Conway Explains It All. To Sarah, I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark, and because I'm not a lawyer, I've asked my good friend George Conway from the Society for the Rule of Law to explain the legal news to me. And guess what, George? We've got legal news this week.
Yeah, finally. Absolutely.
Are you excited? A superseding indictment. I don't really know what that means, but there's a superseding indictment that was brought down by the new D.C. grand jury in the January 6th case this week. What does that mean? Tell us.
A superseding indictment is basically an amended indictment. In a civil case, it would be an amended complaint. It's essentially like version 2.0 of the original indictment. And what the special counsel did there was to edit the indictment to comply with the Supreme Court's erroneous decision on immunity. The Supreme Court held the most biggest change in the indictment was to get rid of conversations that Trump had with other members of the government, leaving apart the vice president, who I'll get to in a minute. Essentially, what the court said was that Trump's consultation with members of his administration, e.g., the Justice Department, were immune from, you know, you couldn't use them as evidence, and you couldn't prosecute him for a crime for conspiring with members of the Justice Department. And so basically, they just took all that stuff involving Jeffrey Clark out of the indictment, and they deleted the reference to the oblique reference. I mean, it wasn't by name, but it was by unindicted co-conspirator number. They deleted that from the indictment, and so that's why the indictment is shorter. And then in other respects, it's just really just word edits here and there, where they just chose to emphasize that Trump was not acting as president for his crimes. The crimes are still the same as they were in the original indictment, but he was acting in his role as a presidential candidate, and that all the people he was consulting with, who he was conspiring with, he was consulting with campaign officials, outside non-government lawyers, and so that basically they just stripped the indictment of references not to him as acting as, you know, as president. They kept references to the vice president, but then the reason why they did that is their position is, and I think it's correct, is that the vice president, when he was talking to Trump, was not talking in his capacity as a member of the executive branch, because Trump and his co-conspirators were trying to influence Mike Pence in his capacity as president of the Senate. And that is not an executive position. And also that Vice President Pence was his running mate. And so that's the other series of edits. And other than that, the indictment charges exactly the same crimes. And so in a way, you could argue that the case is now stronger because it's more focused. It was already a streamlined case against one defendant. And the fact of the matter is, if you strike out all the Justice Department allegations, the allegations of him talking to other people within the executive branch, you still have a very robust pile of evidence that will put him away.
Yeah, so this is what's super interesting to me. And I guess it seems like a very strategic move by Jack Smith, because otherwise, right, what they would have had to do is litigate these individual situations, right? Like when the case came up. So instead, he's just like, nope, we're not going to do that. I'm just going to repanel, like, or impanel, whatever it is, a jury and or a grand jury. And we're going to do this without those other things. And I think it's interesting because Jack Smith's essentially, correct me if I'm wrong, he's kind of at the vanguard of trying to figure out how to try these cases where you sort of upfront accept the immunity stuff, right? And and it's interesting, too, because there is a lot, like, it seems like he was pretty quickly able to think about things in that separated way, like the ellipse, right? What happened, the speech on the ellipse, which is so central, right? That's where Donald Trump said, you know, if we don't fight, we're not going to have a country anymore, and we're going to go down to the Capitol. You know, delineating that that was done in a campaign capacity,
right?
And
privately funded.
That was privately funded and not an executive capacity, makes it fair game. And now, but I guess my question is, can they challenge some of these things? So, for example, you made the point about Pence. That he was operating in his capacity as president of the Senate, not as vice president. Is that something that they will challenge?
They'll challenge whatever they can, because they're going to want to create more satellite litigation to delay this. And that satellite litigation will occur after the election, in all likelihood. And, you know, they're going to try to nitpick at what's left, but they don't have much to pick at. And, I mean, this was really a show of strength by special counsel, by showing it's like, okay, we can take that. We still got, you know, we're still standing. We got 80% of our case still here, and it's still a slam dunk case. And the other point that you made actually is one I should have made, the point about the grand jury. What Smith did was he presented this indictment and the evidence needed to obtain the indictment to show that the grand jury that there was probable cause to a new grand jury, so that no argument can be made that this grand jury, which issued the superseding indictment, was in any way tainted by evidence that the Supreme Court said was out of bounds. So it really is a show of strength by Jack Smith, and it really, I think, is absolutely the right move. And we'll have to see whether or not there'll be a mini trial. There still could be a mini trial on this indictment, where if Trump does, as we would expect, he would try to figure out ways to argue that, well, you can't really separate the official from the unofficial and so on and so forth, and that Pence was really acting in his official capacity as an executive official. It's like, okay, fine. They can put on a mini trial. Maybe that can happen. You know, I don't think it will happen in the next few weeks, but it could. And you could actually see Mike Pence on the stand. And they would ask him, like, okay, what were you doing? What were you acting as? You know, you could ask all sorts of questions, and it would preview the evidence at the trial. And so, you know, that case isn't going away unless Donald Trump wins this election, and it's increasingly, knock on wood, increasingly apparent that I don't think he will.
You know, I remember you mentioning the mini trial as a possibility. Did you think, though, that Jack Smith, I can't remember if we ever talked about this, did you think it was possible he might just repanel a new grand jury?
I think that was always a possibility, you know, and it made sense for him to do that. And I think we were focused on the mini trial because we were hoping, I was hoping that we'd get a preview of the evidence so that the American people could see it before November 5th. But that's not really the purpose of this criminal litigation. The purpose of the criminal litigation is to, is to impose consequences for criminal offenses.
Well, speaking of which, so do you think anything will happen with this case now that he's has a new grand jury? Will anything happen with it before the election? Or is that the mini trial you're saying?
That's the most that could happen. I think what will happen is the next thing will happen is that there will be a conference on what to do and how to schedule it, which was deferred. The Trump lawyers asked for a deferral of a conference that Judge Chutkan had scheduled, and the Justice Department acceded to that request. And the reason why we know now the Justice Department acceded to that request, many people were upset by that, was that they were pulling this move, which was a very smart and agile move. And so now the judge is going to have to hold a conference, and I don't know if it's already scheduled, it may be on the books already, to basically say, okay, what are you going to do, Trump? Are you going to make another motion? And if you do, you've got to get your papers in on this date, and you have to get your papers in on this date, Jack Smith. Or she might say, well, we need to, if you're making that motion, make it a motion, and let's hear some evidence on that motion. So that which would precipitate a mini trial. I don't know that it's, you know, in 10 weeks that's going to happen. I think what will likely happen will be you'll have that conference where the judge is a scheduling conference, and then you'll have some briefs that are filed before the election, but there won't be a decision or a mini trial before the election. But it's possible it could be.
That's interesting. So is it safe to say this trial then really only goes forward, or the case really only goes forward if Harris wins?
Correct.
And then if she does win, how well positioned is this case now to convict Trump?
Oh, it's extremely well. And if you look at the evidence, I mean, there's no question they were lying. They were trying to obstruct a congressional proceeding. So they were both. The three charges are conspiring to defraud the United States. And they basically had a far flung conspiracy to basically lie about the election results and then submit false electoral certificates. And that's classic. Whenever you engage in a conspiracy to submit false information to the government and defraud the government, that's conspiracy to defraud the United States under 18 U.S.C. 371. They also clearly were trying to obstruct a congressional proceeding, which is an official proceeding under 18 U.S.C. 1512, and that's chargeable. And the third is, I don't remember the statute for this one, but it's by a conspiracy to deprive people of their civil rights, namely their right to vote and have their votes counted. And, you know, they did all those things, and they did all those things, you know, I mean, Rudy Giuliani is co-conspirator number one, and Kenneth Cheeseborough, I think, is co-conspirator number two or three. I mean, this was not a government operation. This was a private operation headed by the President of the United States, but not in his capacity as President of the United States, and there's just plenty of evidence to support it. And, I think a jury in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia is going to convict him easily. The District of Columbia is a great venue for this. It's got the smartest, you know, the most educated population in America is literally in the District of Columbia. I mean, there are more people with educations, advanced education than anywhere else in the country. And this, you're going to get a smart jury, and you're not going to get a bunch of MAGAs. So I think he's going to go down if this case is continued to be prosecuted after he loses the election, which I expect it will be.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You look amazing. What have you been doing?
You've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, if you qualify, Zelthy providers can prescribe semaglutide, the same active ingredient, at up to 90% less without insurance. Done all online.
No wait at the doctor's office or pharmacy?
No wait. Zelthy can ship the same active ingredients as other expensive GLP-1s to your door.
Get started with Zelthy today for just $39. Call #250 and say keyword care. That's the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less. That's #250 keyword care.
I want to go just back really quickly to something we kind of gave short shrift and see if we can dig in on it a little bit. So the original indictment had this 5-page section that described Trump's attempts to leverage the Justice Department against state officials. So that is no longer in the superseding indictment because of the immunity decision. And it said that the immunity decision basically said that the president's discussions with members of the Justice Department were part of his core constitutional powers and therefore absolutely immune.
Right.
What does this mean going forward for the way a president deals with the justice, their own Justice Department? If they're all those conversations are always, can they, that means that a president could leverage the Justice Department to do whatever they wanted, prosecute whoever they wanted?
Unfortunately, that is what it means. I mean, it means that if the president has discussions with the Joint Chiefs of Staff on bombing Democrats in the city of Chicago, you know, that would, you know, they would also, by parity of logic, it would also be immune because he's acting in his capacity, however illegally, he's acting in his capacity as head of the armed forces. It's a very, very disturbing decision. And it flows from the Supreme Court's view that we're not going to look at what the motivation was of the president. We're not going to look at whether or not he's acting in good faith. And we're not going to look at whether or not he's acting in his own interest versus that of the nation. We're just not going to pass judgment on that. And I think that's a grievous error. There's nothing in the Constitution or the history of the Constitution that grants that sort of immunity. And they're just flat out wrong on that. But that being said, so much of the conspiracy here involved non-government officials and involved non-governmental acts like forging these certificates. Those were, you know, that was done by Republican Party operatives at the behest of outside lawyers. That there's just so much here that just does not even fall remotely within the scope of official acts that he there's more than enough here to send him to prison for several years.
I have one more sort of weird question, which is it hard to do what Jack Smith did? Like, is it hard to, did it take a lot of work to reconstitute the case and take, so then it was it, was it not an obvious thing to do?
No, it wasn't obvious.
People treated it like it was a bombshell. Oh my gosh, this is amazing.
It really. I mean, if you look at it, basically they excised all the stuff about the Justice Department, right? Which was like a few pages of bullet points, and other than that, it was just wordsmithing.
So then why not just do it right away? Like this.
Well, I think that the innovation was he decided to put it to a new grand jury, which was a very smart move. I never really thought that through. I mean, I think everyone assumed that there might be a superseding indictment or the government can basically say we're not going to proceed on paragraphs 45 through 62. You could just do that. It's not necessary to, I mean, the government can basically just say, we're just not going to put evidence on an indictment without amending the indictment. But they decided to do that, and they decided to do it in the most prophylactic way by basically by presenting it to a new grand jury and just starting afresh, and it's that's going to make it that much harder for Trump to challenge at the end of the day.
So do you think Trump's team is caught by surprise by this?
I don't know. I don't know whether they were caught by surprise. They might have been. I mean, obviously they would be thinking about exactly trying to guess what Jack Smith would do than I would, because I'm not getting paid and it's not my job to spend 40 hours
sure.
a week thinking about it. So I don't know whether they were surprised. There may have been discussions that might have given, you know, internal discussions between the Justice Department, even though they're subject to grand jury secrecy, is we are going to amend the indictment somehow without saying that what's being presented to the grand jury or a new grand jury. They may have known. They may have actually known. That's why, and they were perfectly happy to accept that because they want this case delayed, and the Justice Department was delaying the case, but for its own reasons.
It's just wild to think that if Donald Trump wins, there is no accountability for any of this.
Correct.
And if he loses, like, there's probably a lot of accountability.
Mm-hmm. And I think that accounts for a lot of the psychological pressure on him. I mean, it's just important to remember and to emphasize over the next 10 weeks that he's not just running for president. He is running from prison.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is dadication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dadication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You look great. What have you been doing?
I found Zelthy. If you qualify, their providers can prescribe the same active ingredients in Ozempic and other expensive GLP-1s for 80 to 90% less without insurance. All of mine shipped right to your door.
Get started with Zelthy today for just $39. Call #250 and say keyword care. That's care to #250.
All right, George, I want to ask you about Jack Smith's other case, the Mar-a-Lago classified documents case. As a reminder to listeners, Judge Cannon dismissed the classified documents case because she believed the process used to appoint special counsel Jack Smith was unconstitutional, which, as we talked about, is bananas, I think is the legal term. And Jack Smith appealed that dismissal to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. Can you talk about that? Like, what are Smith's main arguments in his appeal?
Yeah, it's very simple, actually. I mean, the main argument that was pressed in the district court was the argument, a bogus argument, which has been rejected by the D.C. Circuit, that the special counsel is not an inferior officer under the Constitution. And what the Constitution says is that the president shall appoint, with the advice and consent of the Senate, heads of departments. And then for other officers, I'm not quoting the language exactly, the Congress can vest the appointment of officials, lesser officials, they don't use the word inferior officials, but that's what the lawyers call them, in the heads of the department, such as the Attorney General and the courts of law. And what the argument here, the judge, Cannon, rejected that argument and accepted the Justice Department's position that the special counsel is an inferior officer, which I think was a wise move on her part. But then she argued, I think based on a bogus argument that Justice Thomas suggested irrelevantly in the immunity case, that the special counsel may not have been properly appointed by statute, that the United States Code does not vest the Attorney General with the authority to appoint special counsel. And that's just wrong, because there are at least five provisions of the United States Code that say that the Justice Department, the Attorney General acting on behalf of the Justice Department, can retain special counsel for processing, for prosecuting civil or criminal litigation. I think, and what she focused on, Judge Cannon, was the fact that these, the most important of these statutes don't use the word retain and not appoint, and she's making a distinction between retention and appointment. Well, there is no such distinction between retention and appointment. If you retain a lawyer to do your will, you're appointing that person to be your legal representative for purposes of drafting that will. It's a synonym, and there's nothing in the Constitution that prohibits Congress from using synonyms. And in addition to that, the Supreme Court of the United States in United States against Nixon addressed this very issue. It addressed whether or not Special Prosecutor Leon Jaworski was properly appointed under the United States Code, and it said that he was under two of these very same statutes. So, you know, the 11th Circuit is bound to follow the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has no basis to overrule its decision. It's plain as day that the Attorney General has the power to appoint lawyers without the consent of Congress and has sufficient statutory authority to do that. In fact, the Attorney General of the United States did that, I think, you know, in the 19th century. I forget what the case was, but there are cases of special counsels going back over 100 years, 150 years. And so it's just not something, it's just not a reasonable position. It's a ridiculous position. And I think the 11th Circuit is going to thoroughly reject it. And, I hope the Supreme Court won't bother with it, because I think the only person who might have any sympathy for the position is Justice Thomas. And, you know, he's clearly going to be demonstrated wrong by the 11th Circuit. Now,
Did he throw that in on purpose? Like, did he throw that in for this reason, to give her something to try to argue?
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Yeah, well, you know, he did that in the other case. Uh-huh. But obviously, you know, the other case, the D.C. Election interference case. But it applies because it's the same special counsel into the Florida case. I think he was, I'm not going to try to get into his head, because he does a lot of things now that I find mystifying, including, you know, accepting large $250,000 gifts of recreational vehicles and so on and so forth. I'm not going to try to get into his head, but it had nothing, it had literally nothing to do with anything that was argued in the immunity case, and yet he threw that in there. So it, you know, if you were to infer from that, what?
Seems weird.
If you were to infer that he was trying to give a lifeline to Trump gratuitously, that's a reasonable inference to draw.
Sorry, but I had interrupted you. Where were you going before that?
No, I think I said everything I wanted to say. Oh, actually, no. There's one other point about this, and the hidden issue or the lurking issue on this appeal is whether or not the 11th Circuit will take it upon itself to say, this is the third time that Judge Cannon has completely effed up, and she's done it all in one direction, and we can no longer trust her to manage and control this case. And they have the power, which is sparely exercised, to throw somebody off the case. And historically, they could throw a judge off the case. They would throw a judge off the case if they basically make three strikes. And this would be the third strike. I mean, there was that earlier litigation involving the search warrant, where she appointed a special master. And then there was another litigation, what was related, another appeal in which she basically prohibited the Justice Department from looking at the search, at the materials it obtained from the search warrant. And she got slammed. I mean, not just reversed, not just, you know, it wasn't just a simple, oh, the district court was wrong. It was like, you're really wrong. This is off the wall. It was we call it bench slapping in the law. And it was a bench slap that could be heard around the world. And this one is equally bad. So if the 11th Circuit wants to, they could basically throw her off this case. That's not going to happen, obviously, until this appeal is resolved. And I don't think this appeal, it's even conceivable that this appeal would be resolved before the election. But that's something to look at. People have pointed out that Smith did not explicitly ask for that.
So that was going to be my question, is like, he, in his appeal, he didn't ask for her to be removed, which I thought for sure he would.
That's a judgment call. I think the 11th Circuit will get the drift, and it's something I think that can be thrown in later. Although I would love to get the opinions of 11th Circuit practitioners. I mean, I've seen I was a law clerk on the Second Circuit in the last century, more years ago than I care to imagine. And I remember instances in which parties did not ask to toss a judge from the case, but they just tossed the judge off the case because it's like, okay, we can't send this back. We don't want to see this garbage up here again, because this judge clearly doesn't get this case and has some issue that's prohibiting him from deciding this case correctly. And one time, I think when the court did that, I remember in an oral argument,
a defense lawyer hammed it up. There was this really horrible judge who had some case. It was a criminal case, and he kept screwing it up, and he was trying to screw the defendants. And the defense lawyer, instead of saying, Judge Constantino was, oh, actually, I mentioned his name, but he's dead, it's okay, was so unfair and should be removed from the case, he says, we all know Judge Constantino to be the fairest and most thoughtful judge in this district. And the judges on the Court of Appeals panel were like, so, you know, sometimes less is more on that, but, you know, sometimes you get what you don't ask for, and maybe that's what he's thinking here. I don't know. I would love to know what their thinking is on that.
Do you just, I would say overall, now having seen Jack Smith handle both of these, do you feel like he's doing a good job?
He's doing an amazing job. Very difficult, unique circumstances. I mean, they deserve the Medal of Freedom or whatever it is that Trump was, you know, trashing. Yeah. Or, no, actually advancing. They deserve an award for what they're doing. And I'm hopeful that they will meet success in the coming years.
Well, obviously, I hope that Kamala Harris wins this election so justice can be done, however it ultimately ends up being meted out. Hey, since I got you here, last time I saw you, we should apologize to our audience for skipping last week, but we were both
partying.
We were at the DNC.
Partying with the Democrat.
tell me about your experience. What'd you think?
I had a great time. It was fun to meet all these people. And, I'd never seen, I'm sure you've been to more Republican conventions than I have. I've been to three. I have never seen a more positive and joyful atmosphere at a political convention.
Yeah.
And I mean, you could just feel the positivity. And, you know, I mean, I think that's one of the things that the Democrats have going for them is just not just momentum, but they're confident, but they're not overconfident in the way that they were in 2016 because they just suffered a near-death experience. And there's something about, you know, you suffer, you know, you see your life flash before your eyes and all of a sudden everything's fresh and new and you're just thrilled just to be here. And they're not just thrilled to be here, they're thrilled to be there with a candidate who really has the tools to knock Trump down. And who makes Trump look just like what he is, a failed, failing, flailing moron and psychopath.
Yeah, you know, I got to say, I've been doing a bunch of focus groups since we got back from the DNC, sort of asking voters how they felt about it. And what's interesting is, and you know, I haven't been to a Republican convention since like Mitt Romney in 2012. Like I was in Tampa. I've never been to a Democratic convention.
I hadn't either.
But one of the things that the voters seem to have picked up on is that the contrast between Democrats, which they saw as hopeful and optimistic, and the Republicans, which someone described it in the group as doom and gloom.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because, you know, the Republicans basically had a convention in a different universe, right? One where Biden was the candidate and they were sure they were going to win.
Yep.
But they also spent their whole time talking about like, oh, how terrible everything maligning is in America.
The country.
And I got to ask you, just because this was my experience, but, you know, it's funny, there were so many Republican speakers that they had there, whether it was former Trump officials, whether it was our friend Adam Kinzinger, and then like the chants of USA, 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 Kamala's speech, which included, you know, talking about our lethal fighting force and our building out the middle class, but also going on offense on immigration. I don't know. Was it just me or did even for lapsed Republicans like ourselves, did it feel like there was something there for us?
Yeah, there was. I mean, basically, we've seen in our lifetimes an incredible role reversal in the parties. We now have one party. The Democrats used to be kind of more doom and gloom, like things are terrible and we need to fix everything and we need to pass new laws and so on and so forth. And they were perceived as negative, particularly in the 70s. And the you know, Reagan kind of fought back with that by saying, we are a shining city on a hill. And
yeah, man.
God
sunny
bless
optimism.
America. God bless the USA. And it's morning in America. And the morning in America, shining city on the hill party now is the Democratic Party. And the gloom and doom and everything's terrible and
we hate people, and you know, it's all Republican now. The positivity is all on the Democratic side, and it really reflects the pathological personality of Donald Trump and the cultism with which he is followed. And it also extends to, and this also goes with the patriotism and the flag waving we saw at the Democratic National Convention, and is that they're the ones who actually want to defend the country. They want to defend the country. They want to defend the country both from external enemies and from internal, and from, you know, they want to defend it from the negativity of Trumpism. And they want to create a unified country. We're never going to agree on all issues, but they want to understand what our commonality is as Americans, even if we disagree on particular issues. And that was, you know, that was part of the Shining City on the Hill, Morning in America theme. And it's, you know, you can be patriotic and disagree, and you don't have to say that, you know, you don't have to say that unless you agree with me on these issues, I can't talk to you, I can't deal with you. But that's essentially where the Republicans are. It's like they don't even believe in issues. It's all about one individual. I mean, the issues that used to unify the Republican Party were, moral issues and character issues, which they've thrown out the door by nominating a criminal psychopath, a convicted felon. National defense, you know, they've elected, to a ticket that basically wants to cede Europe to the Russians. And, you know, on economics, the Republicans were the kings of wasteful spending and deficit spending in their 4 years in office. The deficit increased more, the national debt increased more than any other 4 years in American history, I believe, leaving apart wars, I think. It's just a complete role reversal of the parties. And I think that, you know, one of the things that Kamala Harris did extremely well in her acceptance speech, and other Democratic speakers and the Republican speakers, was emphasize, we're in this together as Americans, okay? And we want, and also, there's also another aspect of it. It's like, the Leave Me Alone party is now the Democratic Party, okay? That's what Tim Walz is talking about, just leave us alone. And, you know, the Republicans want to basically, you know, monitor
pregnancies,
women's cycles. The libertarian, there's a libertarian aspect to it. It's really remarkable to see this happen in just a matter of really in 8 to 12 years. It's just incredible.
You know, you're talking about something that I've been hitting on lately, too, that I think is important, that in the sort of internecine fight between sort of former conservatives or continuing to be conservatives, but no longer identify with the movement that was conservatism. One of the things that those folks who are sticking around and sort of saying, well, either it means they got to vote for Trump or they need to oppose Kamala Harris, is they're kind of like huffing those Reagan fumes, right? Like, they seem to think the party has stayed the party of conservatism or the party of, you know, limited government, free markets, American leadership in the world, and Democrats are still, these sort of statist, big government types that, you know, have...
They're communists.
...policy. But it everything you just said tracks for me in a lot of ways. We're like... Part of the problem I have with, look, I think on a, from a moral standpoint, I couldn't justify voting for Trump anyway. But even if it were about just the policies, correct, I would look at the policies and be like, well, those aren't the policies that made me join the Republican Party. Like, and in fact, I've watched a lot of conservatives find their thumbs to complain about Kamala Harris's economic policies as she's rolling them out. I actually don't love them either. But you know what? You know who she's stealing them from? Trump. Trump is also coming up with these dumb populist economic policies. Right. And tariffs and a lot of the protectionists.
Economics, the parties are awash, in my view.
Yeah.
And then on national security,
Democrats are better.
Democrats are 20 times better now.
20 times better. Like Donald Trump. Right. And then the Tucker
Donald Trump managed
sort of
to fuck up the Ukraine war without even being president by having the House block aid to Ukraine for many months.
Yep.
That's just amazing to me. And it's just,
even on that alone, even apart from the fact that Trump is just a grievously flawed and criminal, I would be voting for the Democratic ticket just on that alone. Yeah. And I don't see any reason to believe the Republicans are really that much better, if at all, on economics. I mean, yeah, I like lower taxes more than the next guy, but you know, if you're not cutting spending, if you can't figure out how to cut spending, I don't want endless deficit spending that's going to burden our children for decades and generations to come.
You know, this was me. And so a big part of me being a conservative was rooted in how I felt about debt and deficit spending.
Right.
And not the least of which was just the mentality of spending money that we don't have, that right. we're borrowing from China, that we can't do it endlessly. I mean, I remember I had a big project back in the day called Defeat the Debt. And it was like, the debt at the time was like $12 trillion. I mean, boy, what we wouldn't give for $12 trillion right now yeah. in debt. And Trump, yeah, he'll cut taxes and he'll do nothing. No change in the corresponding spending.
Right.
They don't even have they've got no plan. This is the other, like the attack on Harris right now is being like, well, we don't know what she stands for. What yeah. policies? I don't know. Do you remember the Republican Party not even putting forward a platform last time yeah. other than we support Donald Trump?
Yeah. I mean, Donald Trump's platform is to put the country into bankruptcy the way he put his businesses into bankruptcy.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Well, this is just you, just two old conservatives,
yeah, old fogies
complaining about
old fogies reliving the past, the memories of the past. But that's, you know, I mean, again, the Democrats have really done a good job of making themselves future oriented while at the same time dumping on Trump
and opening up that tent. I mean, absolutely. I was struck by how much yeah. I felt like they understood the assignment right. of trying yeah. to bring new people into the coalition for this moment.
Yeah. And I also think that they basically, you know, somebody just wrote, and I was reading it the other day, that they made the point, an obvious point, that not too long ago, there were equal numbers of wackos in both parties with equal amount.
Oh, this is Iglesias's column today.
Yeah, now it's like the Democrats have tamped their wackos down, and the Republicans have basically given them the keys to the store, and that's another big difference between the two parties, and as a result, they are going to. I firmly believe they're going to expand the tent, and they are going to win over. Middle class voters in the suburbs of America who, would vote for a Paul Ryan or vote for a Mitt Romney or did vote for them both, and they're now those people are going to lean. They're going to think seriously about voting for Harris and Waltz.
Yeah, congrats to Donald Trump for securing the endorsements of Tulsi Gabbard, Elon, and. Who was the other?
RFK.
Oh, RFK. RFK. Yeah.
I can't bear to mention him.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a whale of an endorsement.
Whale of an endorsement. It is just like Donald Trump, all former Democrats, actually.
Right.
And that's exactly the point that Iglesias, I think, is making, is that those cranks have all now consolidated
right.
in
right.
the Republican Party.
Right.
So you know what? They can have them. They
Absolutely.
Can have them.
Absolutely.
All right, George, thanks as always for talking about the legal news with me. And
next week we're going to do this from Texas.
Next week we're doing it live, guys. We're going to do it live. All right, don't forget to hit the subscribe button. Leave us a review on your podcast app. Email us at askgeorge@thebulwark.com. And we will see you next week in Texas. Bye-bye.
Well, George Conway, he's a man with a plan. Got to sit down with Sarah Longwell, take a stand. Explain all the legal problems they're piling high. With Donald Trump. Oh my, oh my, oh my. He said, Sarah, let me break it down for you. There's obstruction of justice, corruption too. The legal tangles and troubles, they're growing fast. It's a storm that's gonna last and last. Oh Conway, tell him well about it. Those legal problems can't live without. Listen close.